Hello, I'm B'nai Naudin, and this is The Process. I'm always impressed with people who can complete a project, such as a book. And my guest today is Patrice Caneda, whom I met through work. She one day told me that she had written a book, and I was curious, and she gave me her book. I read it. I thought it was interesting. And when I decided to do this podcast, I thought, maybe I can interview her. And so here we go. Patrice has lived in Connecticut for many decades. She was an elementary school teacher in Woodstock, Connecticut. She has lived in Japan. Her husband is Japanese, and she describes herself as having juggled lives in Japan, Chicago, Connecticut, and Miami Beach since her retirement as a special education teacher. From 1991, she taught English at Konan University in Japan and lectured on learning disabilities. I was really happy to have her come and talk about her book, which relates to her family, but also the larger Canadian family, the French-Canadian family that migrated to the U.S. So it's a historical book. It's not completely fact. It's not completely fiction. It's a blend of the two, and she will explain that a little more during our interview. So here goes nothing. I'm sitting with local author Patrice Demare Caneda to talk about her book, A Tale of Two Migrations, A French-Canadian Odyssey. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, B'nai. It's really fortuitous to be recording this today because this year is the 375th anniversary of the arrival of the Demers family in French Canada.
Wow.
My ancestor, Jehan Dumois, the name went through several transitions, was born so long ago, around 1525.
So it's been a while since they came. All right, so tell me what prompted you to write A Tale of Two Migrations.
Strangely, cognitive dissonance, if you will. I made the transition from my French Little Canada in Southbridge, Massachusetts at the age of 13 and moved to Woodstock, Connecticut. It was 7 miles away, but it was a world away. I moved from a French Catholic town, Democratic town in general, to a mostly Yankee, if you will, Republican Protestant town. And I arrived there with a lot of pride in my family, in my heritage, only to find that people made a lot of derogatory comments about French Canadians on both sides of them in the town of Putnam and in the town of Southbridge. For a while, I tried to ignore my own background. But later in life, I really, really wanted to tell the world and tell other French Canadians about their heritage. For there was a time when I thought, why did my people come to Canada? What were the reasons? I didn't know anything about it. But I went into a lot of research, and now I know a lot more than I did then.
So what are the two migrations that you have from the title? What do they entail?
The first migration was mostly by men, and it was a matter of commerce. They went to French Canada for commerce. And after Champlain's discovery and Joliet's discovery and Cartier's discovery of the land, the cod fishing was a huge industry. And then word got to France in the time of Louis XIV that there were a lot of opportunities for commerce there. So after the cod industry, the next biggest industry was the fur trading. And that, again, involved men.
So that was the first
migration. That was the first migration.
Uh-huh. And what about the second?
The second migration occurred after the British took over French Canada. And after that time, the French were really, really treated as second-class citizens. They couldn't hold office. They moved to the countryside. They were farmers. The farms were not good. They had huge families. It was a very bad time. At the same time, the New England mills were starting, and there were many opportunities for workers. So drawing the French from French Canada to New England became a big industry. Actually going to Canada to recruit people to come to work in the mills. So that was in the 1880s, more or less.
Okay. What was the main difference you found between the migration of French men and French women? You said originally it was men who came. When did the women come? Were there some women in the first migrations in terms of the first ships over from France, or how
there
did that
work?
There
were very few women, but my seventh great-grandmother came early. She came at a time when her husband, Jean, had moved from Quebec to Montreal, and there were only 500 people there. But the majority of the women came later at the recruitment of the daughters of the king.
So what did the king want?
The king wanted the population to grow. They realized that the population in New England was growing because families migrated to New England, but French Canada was not growing. So they instituted this program to lure women to French Canada to be wives, and they offered them dowries.
And what type of women came over? What was the stipulation?
There's a great deal of research that's been done, and they actually know the names of these women and what their ranks were in society. Many of them were poor. Many of them were truly destitute. Others were from wealthy families that had run out of dowry for their fifth or sixth daughter. And that was pretty much the makeup of the young women. I'd like to read to you the sign that was put up all over France by King Louis XIV. Wanted by request of King Louis XIV, daughters of the king, 1,000 strong women of marriageable age, 14 to 40, to go to New France as brides. The following will be accepted: orphans and widows, a girl accompanied by one parent, no girl going to join a fiancé or a husband will be accepted. Upon the signing of a marriage contract in New France, a dowry will be presented along with a sum of up to 200 francs. If you are of good health and good morals, go to the king's agent at City Hall.
I can imagine there was quite an onslaught at the time, don't you think? Or
yes, and the number ended up with, you know, I think around 836, mm-hmm. more or less.
Okay.
Yes. And actually, I heard that one or two women went and turned right around and got back on the ship.
And why do you think that was?
They had never expected what they saw, which was a lot of trees, a lot of wilderness, a few men waiting for them.
All right. So that brings us into the early days of Nouvelle France. You know, what was it like there? You say there was a lot of wilderness, and what you say the population was rather small. So You know, what were people doing? What was the place like?
Well, actually, some of the earliest women to go there were religious women. They were nuns. And I was very impressed when I visited Maison Gabrielle in Montreal, where they welcomed these women and they taught them the skills that they would need, how to cook, game, how to grow their food in the gardens. A lot of the information about food had come from the native people who lived there. They learned about corn and squash and other things. They had to change their style of dressing and wear their dresses a little bit shorter. And they learned to wear moccasins and snowshoes. And it was a very hard life.
Mm-hmm. And how were they was there matchmaking? How were they married off? They were allowed to choose?
Allowed to choose, which was a greater privilege than they would have experienced in France. They actually had quite a bit of power, and they did not have to choose immediately. They could take up to 3 months to make a choice.
3 months is pretty fast, though, too.
And they had Carignan soldiers who had been there for quite a while, the French regiments of soldiers who'd been there. Some chose to marry a soldier. There were a few entrepreneurs, a lot of farmers, and, of course, trappers who would be away much of the time.
So people were farming, people were hunting, people were doing different things. What kind of challenges did they face?
They faced very difficult winters. There were still skirmishes with natives. The general problems of settlement in a foreign land, the ships didn't come very frequently from France. They lacked goods. But overall, they had plenty of food because of the game and plenty of fish from the ocean and from the lakes and the rivers and the streams. And they learned to harvest cranberries. They, of course, there was maple syrup. To this day, it's a big Canadian industry.
Mm-hmm. Who was in charge there? Were there local governments? Who was ruling the land?
First of all, the power came from the king, and the power came from the church. And different levels of power went all the way down to the town. So they were really, they even had seigneurs, the rich landowners who owned large pieces of land. And it was almost, in the early days, like a remnant of the feudal system.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a word in there called habitant, inhabitant. What were the habitants? Were they a particular class of inhabitants? Or
they were the farmers. But again, that relates more to the feudal system, where they were supposed to give a share of their crops to the seigneur, the lord. So the life of the habitant was tough, because they had huge families. And every new child who was born was just another pair of hands. It was a difficult time to be a child.
You mentioned in your book about the families, if they reached 10 children, then they got a special stipend, I guess, from
the
king?
Yes.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, once again, they really wanted the population to increase. So it was another idea that came from France between the king and Talon, his secretary, to encourage the French to have more children. So they were promised a stipend for each additional child that they have. And when it reached 12 or more, they got even more money. And in my own family history, my ancestor, Jean de Meurse, and his wife had 12 children. They had a child born every other year. Talk about family planning.
Yeah, so what was Jean doing in the Nouvelle France? What was his job?
Well, the three Demers' brothers, who came with their father, who was the ship's carpenter, were all carpenters, and they were very skilled carpenters. So they were busy from the very beginning building the cathedral. And after a while, Jean and his brother, André, chose to go to Montreal because it was even wilder than Quebec, and there was more to do there. And there, as I said, there were only 500 people when Jean and Jeanne were married. And again, he was working as a carpenter and soon became a landowner. And later, he and his wife and his family, which by that time probably numbered 4, later to be 12, returned to Quebec and took over the house that his brother had started, and it stands today in Old Quebec. And you can walk down the stairway to Lower Quebec from the Chateau Frontenac and see the plaque of the Demers family house, which is right there on the corner.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. So you've obviously visited.
Very often.
Uh-huh. Okay. You mentioned some native peoples there. Which tribes were present in the vicinity?
Well, the Iroquois were considered the enemy because they were allied with the British. So there was always the risk of attacks, especially in the early days, by the Iroquois, who were, by the way, very skilled hunters and marksmen. The Hurons were what they called the good Indians. They were Catholic and peaceful and were the enemies of the Iroquois.
And both of these tribes were in the Quebec area?
Well, the Iroquois were mostly in New York, but there were attacks on Montreal by the Iroquois.
What was the relationship with the good Indians then? What kind of relationships did people have with them?
They went to church. They traded. They sought medical help from each other. The French learned about herbs from the Indians, and the Indians sought medical help at the little hospitals. And actually, the sisters, the nuns who were there, were trying to convert as many as they could. But it's very amusing to hear that the Indians sometimes gave them a daughter to convert, but it was a daughter that they had kidnapped.
From
another Indian tribe. That was very common.
Okay. So they wouldn't sacrifice their own children to the Catholic faith then.
Exactly.
Okay. When I was reading your book, I was struck by some of the laws that existed and the types of punishment that were used. Can you talk about those a little bit? Why, you know, what, as you said, the church was really the law and the seigneurie, the seigneurs.
Yes. Well, remember, the Reformation was going on in France, so they already knew a lot about torture. So for the greatest crimes, somebody could be burned to death or hanged or guillotined. The crimes could be dancing and singing on Sundays. There were a lot of myths about it, that if you had gone dancing on a Sunday, you might tap your maple tree and blood will run out of it. Also, homosexuality was severely punished. There were 2 young men found in a compromising position, and the young man was asked if he'd rather burn to death or become the executioner, and he chose to be the executioner. It was tough. And there were so many holy days when they had to eat fish. So there was a lot of fishing that went on just to satisfy the Catholic Church's demands that they eat fish on holy days.
I was very surprised about the dancing and singing. So, I mean, today it just seems unheard of. But I guess it still exists, obviously, in some religions today.
Yes, it does.
So it's not really that strange.
And there was a great deal of dancing and singing, music in general, in these big French families. except that it couldn't be on Sunday.
Wow. Okay. So what are some of the events that prompted your ancestors to move to New England to do this second migration to the United States, which wasn't, you know, which was still kind of wild as well, but much different?
Well, the primary thing was that French Canada did not have a good banking system. The farms were not good. The French were basically, the French who came were basically not farmers, as they were workers. They were blacksmiths and surveyors and carpenters. So farming was never very lucrative for them. And then when these opportunities came up to work in the mills, that's what they did. But in the case of my family members were entrepreneurs. So wherever there were mills, there could be stores and bakeries, and there would be real estate. And that's what my family got involved in the 1880s.
And what year did some of your family members move here?
In the 1880s. And these were my great uncles. And actually, I got to know at least one of them. So he's not just my ancestor, but he's actually was my great uncle whom I knew.
Mm-hmm.
He had a large bakery and was in real estate. And all of my ancestors moved to Southbridge, Mass.
Okay, so Southbridge was a big center. What other big centers were there in New England?
Lowell, Woonsocket, Chicopee, Putnam. These towns were called the Little Canadas.
What kind of work did your family do? You said they were entrepreneurs. One great uncle had a bakery.
Yes, another uncle opened a savings bank. And several of them worked in a small market, and real estate was also a big part of their business enterprise.
Mm-hmm. And why did they choose Southbridge over, let's say, Fall River or another town, Lowell? Or was there a reason why Southbridge?
Well, Southbridge was thriving, and what often happened is that someone from a town would actually go to Quebec or Montreal and talk with people to try to convince them to come and to explain the railroad system. Some people came by train. They had interpreters on the train. The tickets were cheap. Other people walked. Other people came by horseback. It was a huge migration.
So representatives of Putnam would go up to Canada and try to recruit people?
It might be a family friend who was going back to visit relatives.
Okay, so a Canadian who had moved there?
They went back frequently. There could be other Canadians who had moved into these Little Canadas, and they went back and said, hey, come on, we're really thriving. There are a lot of jobs. You'll do a lot better. And so actually, as it says on my back cover, between 1840 and 1930, millions of people passed through Ellis Island, but the descendants of the 10,000 original settlers of Nouvelle France, French and Canada, made their way to New England to a new life during that same period. So there was a lot of migration going on in the whole world.
How did they hear about it originally? I mean, was there news? How did they find out? Did they travel themselves just to see what was going on in the colony, you know, the American colony? Or were they...
First of all, French Canada ruled all the way to New Orleans.
Oh, okay.
Even Chicago was called La Louisiane. It was part of La Louisiane.
Mm-hmm.
And with Jefferson's purchase,
the Louisiana purchase,
that was the biggest bargain the United States ever got, because the French had been fighting so many wars that they depleted their coffers.
Mm-hmm.
But they had already had experience in the United States.
Okay, so the people in Quebec and Montreal heard from these other Canadians, French Canadians, that things could be interesting in New England. What was Southbridge like when they came? So there were a couple of mills. How many mills do you think? Lots of mills?
There were quite a few mills, and the industry was amazing.
Was it mostly textile mills, or was it
woolen mills, cotton mills? Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, so you said it was mostly Canadian?
There were Irish, there were Italians, but Southbridge at one point was 60% Quebecois, which is minority majority.
Mm-hmm. And you were born there?
I was born there in 1935.
And so you were part of that community. It was still vibrant?
It was very vibrant.
And everybody spoke French?
Everybody I knew spoke French because I lived in a very, very French neighborhood. The town was divided into little neighborhoods, more or less. People from various ethnic groups grouped together in their neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. In your introduction, you say that you decided to tell the story of your family using a combination of history, fiction, and memoir. So did you create characters, or are all the people that you mention in the book historically existing?
I created a lot of characters. The history part is real, but the characters are fictitious. And were I to write the book now, it would be a very different book because I never stopped researching. And now I have a lot more information about my ancestors than I did when I wrote the book, in spite of the fact that it took me 7 years to write it.
Okay, and how did you come about writing it? How did that happen?
I started at Northwestern University in a writing group, and I was writing a story a week, and people were asking for more and more and enjoying it, and it was all news to them. No one had any knowledge of this French history, and so they encouraged me, and it became a book.
And you said you did a lot of research, but also you probably heard a lot of family stories. What kind of family stories were shared that are included in the book?
First of all, my parents were born in the U.S., and they were very interested in the moment. They saw their flapper aunts, and they enjoyed the vibrant life in Southbridge, so they didn't talk about Canada very much. My one grandmother, my maternal grandmother, did a little more talking about Canada. And I got some information from her. The most exciting was about Jean-Baptiste the Pirate. Everybody seemed to talk about him, and he was responsible in part for the Deerfield Massacre, because he had been taken prisoner by the British and they wanted to trade somebody for him. And that is actually what was behind the Deerfield Massacre, when Indians came from Quebec with the French and attacked Deerfield.
Hmm.
They wanted to trade the minister for Jean-Baptiste. I have not been able to trace his line, my line, directly to him, but that was what we were told, that Jean-Baptiste was our man.
So that's kind of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So you invented a lot of characters, and did you sort of come up with stories as you were doing research, or were these, how did that come about?
Yes, when I was researching Daughters of the King, I was able to find my characters for the women there, reading about their backgrounds. I did a lot of research at the Chicago Public Library. It was such a thrill to go into the special room where I had to wear white gloves just to touch the maps and to look at a map drawn by Champlain. It was very interesting. And then I traveled to every place that I wrote about. I spent a lot of time in Dieppe, in La Rochelle, in France. I went to the place where Samuel Champlain was born, to Brouage. And in Canada, I visited the little towns along the St. Lawrence where some of my relatives lived, and of course, Quebec City and Montreal. So it's been quite a trip.
And you mentioned handling maps and things like that. What other primary source documents did you consult? Did you find letters, captain's logs, or things like that?
The letters that were available were the letters of the Jesuits. And these letters that the Jesuits wrote, they were some of the earliest people to go to French Canada. And they would send letters to France, and they were read with great interest by the French during that time, even before the Daughters of the King. So they had a lot of knowledge about what was going on in Canada at that time.
And what kind of materials really impacted your storytelling, sort of guided you? Do you remember any of the specific documents that might have triggered certain things?
Well, I read a lot of Francis Parkman's work. These are really tombs. Francis Parkman was such a voracious writer. It was just amazing. He wrote two volumes, France and England in the New World, and that impressed me a great deal. And then there is a book entitled The White and the Gold by Thomas Costain. And then there's another book entitled Along a River, The First French-Canadian Women. So these were very interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. And the Daughters of the King, they were the ones that were sent over to propagate...
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned a few books here. Are those some books that you would recommend people read if they're
yes,
interested in finding out more about this period?
Yes. I visited Lowell, which is a national historic site. And you can find a lot of information by visiting. I would strongly recommend a visit to Lowell.
You are currently working on something new. Is that not correct?
Yes, I am. And it's quite a change from writing about these migrations. It's more related to my migration. My husband is Japanese, and I moved to Japan and lived there for 9 years. And I have just completed a book entitled What They Whispered. I have yet to publish it, but it's done and it's sitting, and time will tell.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for talking to us. I was talking to Patrice Demare Caneda, and she is the author of A Tale of Two Migrations, A French-Canadian Odyssey. The book was published in 2012, is that correct?
Yes, and I'm happy to say it remained among the top 10 on Amazon in regarding French history, French-Canadian history, for all these years. It's done quite well.
All right. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, and good luck on your next book.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed hearing about Patrice Caneda and her book. This was my first official interview for The Process, so I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to thank WHUS Stores for making this podcast possible, and the students who trained me and guided me through the process. Next week, I'll be talking to local artist Annie Wandel. Hope you tune in. Thanks.